Somewhere in between, this is Spinal Tap and pop star Never Stop Never Stopping, Chris Rock made a music industry comedy that lampooned both 90s hip-hop and literally every American's reaction to 90s hip-hop. CB4 was the number one movie in America.
The number one movie in America.
Movie in America.
Movie in America.
The number one movie in America.
This is the number one movie in America. I'm Sean Collier. I'm here with two people of ancient civilizations that we will not dive into. It's Robin Hitchcock.
Scorping out.
I got you the bit.ly you wanted. And Camila Adams.
Not scorping out.
I just watched, I should credit the person, but someone on my Facebook post of last week's episode posted a video of some guys fixing the CGI in the Mummy Returns Rock Scorp out scene. And they made it considerably better, which is not surprising because it's 18 years later. But it was a demonstration of how far we've come that, okay, like, four guys with a YouTube in 24 hours produced a better result than Universal Pictures could 18 years ago.
Yeah.
It was moving quickly.
I feel like that's unfair, though. I think that Universal Pictures could have done better in 2002.
Really?
I really do believe that in my heart.
It did not have to look like Brendan Fraser got to the final boss of a video game he was playing off screen.
Correct.
You think maybe they just ran out of money at that point and they just gave up? They're like, you know what? We're not going to keep going on with this. Let's just do what we can with what we've got.
Notice how even now we're not talking about the Scorpion King in the moment of the show where we throw back to last week's episode. Right. We're still talking about The Mummy Returns, because why would you? No, we're moving on. We were excited to draw CB4 because it was a moment of discovery for me and Robin.
Well, a moment of discovery, because I knew about it, but I had never seen it. I had no interest in it whatsoever. I've never been one for gangster rap. Really, and Chris Rock was definitely not a reason for me to watch a movie, especially not in 93, like a baby Chris Rock. Well, no, this is an adolescent Chris Rock.
Yeah, as we've established. But Tony was working overtime this week, ignoring the Scorpion King, which I guess we just caught Tony napping at that moment. But if you go from Beverly Hills Cop to CB4,
right,
we get two of Chris Rock's first few movies. Mm-hmm. We go from Eddie Murphy to Charlie Murphy. we retain Ice-T briefly, right, from Breakin'. Not only that, thanks to those who joined us for trivia last week, there was a question in our trivia: which of these four rappers was in Breakin'?
Right.
And three of them were in CB4.
Right.
The only one that wasn't was Eric B., who was mentioned three times.
Right, he was, and there was definitely a poster of him. So
yeah.
Also, while we're talking about Tony's invisible hand, the original draw was for 50 Shades Freed, and few days before the episode would have come out if I didn't veto it, Dakota Johnson came out as bisexual.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to keep us relevant.
Always. Thank you, Tony.
Yeah.
I'd like to thank the 60 plus listeners, because I looked at the analytics this week, nice, that heard us draw 50 Shades Freed, heard us veto it, went, aw, and went back and listened to the old episode with me and Robin
listening to
50 Shades Freed. Thanks, guys.
That's awesome.
Thank you.
That's amazing. So, you know, people were still interested in what you guys had to say about 50 Shades.
I mean, that was a huge part of why I vetoed it. I'm like, this is redundant.
This is available content. No, but CB4. But CB4. What an interesting slice of, I don't want to say footnote, but footnote of movie and music history to have stumbled upon. And here to summarize that film with this week's 60-second recap, it's Robin Hitchcock.
I'm not going to rap. You can all breathe a sigh of relief.
I was on the edge of my seat.
And go.
So CB4 starts out as a rapumentary by A. White, which is its best joke. And it's Chris Rock as MC Gusto. And then we've got Deezer D as Stabmaster Arson and some other guy I didn't recognize as Dead Mike. Also good jokes. But then the rest of the movie is just kind of, they are a gangster rap group and they're kind of lying because they're from the suburbs. Eddie Murphy's boring brother is the antagonist who is easily defeated by Chris Rock dressing in drag, pretending to be Candy Alexander, who is kind of this sexist character named Sissy who has sex with everyone else. The kid from the Mighty Ducks says the N-word and they rap. The end.
That was under 60 seconds.
Yeah. Going plot point by plot point is really not worth my time. And then the rest would be, I liked this joke didn't work, which I figured we could do in more than 60 seconds.
I liked the movie.
Oh, so did I.
But, you know, to the recap, it all hinges on one plot development that never even internally makes sense. So, like, Charlie Murphy plays a low-level drug crime dealer, lord-ish. Like, whatever.
What were you putting in air quotes, Camila?
Crime lord, like a low-level right. crime lord.
Named Gusto, and Chris Rock's character is there when he gets arrested, and Gusto thinks that he talked to the cops, and somehow this leads Chris Rock's character, what's his name? Albert, to take the name Gusto, like as if other names aren't available. Like it's all about, oh man, when Gusto gets out, we're in trouble. But there was no reason for him to do that and no right. benefit to him doing that.
Exactly. It's not like Gusto was a gangsta, like a street gangsta, like they were portraying themselves to be, which is like kind of ridiculous, which is even more ridiculous why they went with the NWA Jerry Curl Juice type of, you know, gangster, where that's not who Gusto was. So I don't right. understand why he decided to take on that name. And he was even like trying to do his walk, I think is what was something that came up too. Like it just doesn't, you're right. It doesn't make any sense like why he even needed to do that. And
okay, here's something else that doesn't make sense to me. So the neighborhood that they, for their like, breakout song is Straight Out of Low Cash, mm-hmm. right? That's their fake neighborhood that mm-hmm. they're from. But the secret is that they're all from the suburbs, right? And right. they're not tough at all. And that's why they steal Charlie Murphy's identity, right?
Right.
But okay, so Low Cash is obviously an attempt at pun humor.
Right.
But was the suburb called Low Cash, or are they pretending to be from a fake neighborhood called Low Cash? Is it worth breaking this down? Probably not.
I think basically like the short answer is just the fact that like I think you're equating suburbs with something a little more than what it's supposed to be where they're concerned. Like this is just
sense.
A little more like middle class is basically, you know, like the working middle class is where they live. Is where they're
right,
from. They're not as far as bad off and like as tough as they pretend that they're, you know, trying to give. They don't have as much street cred as they're trying to give themselves, but they're also not as affluent as, you know, one would assume. But, you know.
Right.
So, yeah.
That's a very good distinction. Thank you. The other thing that I meant to mention in my recap is that this gives up on the documentary conceit, like, immediately. Like Chris Elliott plays A. White at some point is like, this is missing something, I need some narrative, and then I guess it becomes a flashback
right
from Chris Rock's character's perspective, but this is not really a Spinal Tap style mockumentary.
No it's not. I wish it were like more of a mockumentary style, because that's
me too.
Spinal Tap is amazing as a mockumentary.
So then go watch Fear of a Black Hat, because this is I started watching Fear of a Black Hat immediately after this. I fell asleep before it was over. But it's weird. Like they use a lot of the same jokes. And Colin was saying, like, well, I guess they're all inspired by the same reality.
Right.
But they just hit better in Fear of a Black Hat. And I thought maybe it's like, you know, when you hear a cover before you hear the original and
right.
then you think that the cover is better. Like,
right.
I don't know how much that's going on with me in Fear of a Black Hat, but like I do genuinely think it's a better movie.
I was saying, like, go watch Straight Outta Compton. I mean, not as a
right.
not as a mockumentary and not as a parody at all, but it's just like, damn, I just want to go watch Straight Outta Compton now.
Yes. And Straight Outta Compton has a little bit more, like, winking humor right. than its reputation. I mean, don't forget, yes. in Straight Outta Compton, like doesn't Ice Cube literally go, I got something to say, and then they cut straight to recording Fuck the Police? And isn't yeah. there a Bi Felicia origin scene?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
In Straight Outta, like,
yeah.
Straight Outta Compton is kind of its own CP4.
It's a little tongue-in-cheek, yeah. I was also surprised to see, like, you know, cameo, like, Eazy-E was in it. First of all, I was like, oh, Eazy-E was still alive when this was made.
I know, that was my reaction, too.
But it was, I thought it was, I guess, not funny, but it was interesting to see that Ice Cube and Eazy-E both made appearances in it, considering, like, that they're clearly, like, trying to, like talk about NWA. That's their parody group that they're going for, so.
But it's loving. This is a very loving parody.
Right.
And one of the things I actually think kind of went wrong with this movie, and again, with the caveat, I actually really enjoyed watching this. Like, I laughed. It just is clearly a flawed movie. And I think one of the problems, and I know what this is like as a comedy writer, when you write something for yourself and part of your motivation is looking cool, right? You're like, I am writing this, like, Frankly Scarlett, my sketch troupe, we have a sketch where we play like femme fatales. Mm. My friend Liz Labaz wrote it and it's great. It makes fun of film noir, but we also all get to act sexy in it and do these tropes that like we grew up with and thought were cool. And so I think that part of what's going on is that Chris Rock wants to be a cool rapper.
Right.
And so there's like extended scenes of them in concert being cool.
So extended.
And it just undercuts all the satire.
Right. It's so ridiculously, there's way too much of the performance. But I guess, you know, we should find out what was going on around this time in 1993 as to why this made it to number one box office.
There you go. Thank you, Angela, for keeping us on track.
Why don't we? Not in the pre-written factsy segment, but I should note that one of the three co-writers, along with Chris Rock and Nelson George, was Robert Locash.
What?
And like, The Locash was like some kind of weird meta joke, but he was the least famous of the writers.
Interesting.
So I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. Who knows where that, again, how much time do you want to spend breaking down the name of the fictional suburb in CP4? which was released March 12th of 1993. It was the sixth number one movie of the year. It won its opening weekend with $6.1 million, a ridiculously close finish between one and two. CP4 and the mostly forgotten alien abduction movie Fire in the Sky both made $6.1 million. CB4 came out on top by less than $6,000. So this was just barely a number one movie in America. There was one other new release that weekend. Remember that time period where Disney made odd live action features that never made money?
Usually the dogs.
I mean, I was the audience for those.
So do you remember A Far Off Place starring teenage Reese Witherspoon?
I do now. Isn't she in Africa?
Yeah, they're in Africa. Yeah. Something about saving a village or something. Yeah. And it debuted in seventh with $3.5 million. That's the confusing thing about all of those to me, is that Disney, like, spent good money making live-action family movies with no hope that they would actually be big hits. Mm. That's the weird thing about that time period.
I think they did have hope. This is something that they address in Waking Sleeping Beauty, that documentary I talked about a while ago. Yeah, so part of Disney's fallow period was desperately clinging to their live-action days, and I think that that carried over into the early 90s.
CB4 fell to CB4th.
I'm sorry, that's very funny to me.
In its second, I felt bad while typing. In its second weekend, behind two debuting films, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3 and Point of No Return, which is the American remake of the movie La Femme Nikita before the American TV show La Femme Nikita. It also fell behind Fire in the Sky in its second weekend. It was not in theaters for very long. It earned $17.9 million. It was certainly a success. The budget was only $6 million, still only finished 81st for the year 1993. Obviously, very big box office year. We saw Chris Rock's first speaking role, as mentioned, just 2 weeks ago in Beverly Hills Cop 2. This was his fifth. In between, he did I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka, New Jack City, and Boomerang. This was his first time as a co-writer. He would not have a film writing credit again until Down to Earth in 2001. This was the second film for director Tamara Davis. Let's talk about her, because we don't get that many female directors to talk about. Her debut, Gun Crazy, the previous year. Some of her other feature credits include Billy Madison, Half Baked, and Britney Spears in Crossroads.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Classic film.
I think that's her last big screen feature. And
she into director jail after that. She does TV now.
She very successfully. She's done Empire, Grey's Anatomy, Ugly Betty, Dead to Me, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. She is constantly working.
She's doing all right.
Yeah. And she directed a lot of music videos, including some of the videos sort of being spoofed in CB4. She started out more in alternative and pop. She did videos beginning in the mid-80s for The Smiths and Depeche Mode and Faith No More, The Bangles. She later directed the videos for Tone Loc's Wild Thing, Young MC's Bust a Move, and MC Light's Cha Cha Cha, among many others. She continued to direct videos through the 90s, including Hanson's Mbop.
You know, this Tamara, she's got quite the range.
I mean, if you're doing Mbop and Billy Madison in the same part of your career, that's
it's about right.
You like to work. As you can see, there's not that many facts about CB4. So to wrap it up with Charlie Murphy, allegedly the Charlie Murphy stories from Chappelle's Show about Prince and Rick James occurred during the filming of CB4.
Yes.
That is very apocryphal, but supposedly that was about this time.
I choose to believe it all is true.
I think I met him. God rest his soul. He's dead. We know he's dead.
Yeah. Like it was a couple years ago. Yeah. It was a couple years ago. I think he had something that nobody knew nobody really knew he was sick. Like
I think he had leukemia.
Gotcha.
And he was eventually just a working road comic. And I met him at the radio 1 week, and like, I have no impression of him. Like he was neither nice nor not nice. He was neither funny nor not funny. It was like this guy I'm sitting next to isn't talking much and looks a lot like Eddie Murphy.
He makes me so sad.
Why?
Because, okay, this is like deep trauma. So my older sister, Becky, is literally a genius. She's super successful. Like, she was one of those people who was really good at school, but still had a lot of friends, which is very annoying. And I fully grew up in her shadow.
Gotcha.
And the idea of your sibling being as famous and talented as Eddie Murphy, and then you trying to ride their coattails and failing so spectacularly hurts me.
Imagine being Brad Pitt's brother, or even the fourth one of the Liam, the
extra
Hemsworth. Yeah, the extra Hemsworth. But like, I mean, Charlie Murphy, I find him funny, and I think it's just because of my own personal life experiences. Like, he reminds me, like, he could be one of my uncles. And it's just like, it's not necessarily the content that he's talking about. It's the way he tells a story. And that's what cracks me the fuck up about him.
Thank you. You have made me feel better.
So, like, personally, like, I was watching him, when I was watching him in this movie, I was just kind of like, maybe it was just because, you know, Beverly Hills Cop was fresh. And I was like, I think I enjoy watching him more than I enjoy watching Eddie. And like, speaking of like, you know, older sibling in somebody's older sibling shadow, when I mentioned before, I met Cuba Gooding Jr.'s brother, little brother, Omar. And I told Omar, I was like, I like you much more than I like your brother. And I'm
this
sure
is that, your brand.
Yeah, right?
Nevertheless, in an audio format, Camila talked over Robin and I were too shocked to make shocked noises. We just made shocked faces.
Right.
We both
I like watching Charlie more than Eddie Murphy.
We both leaned back.
It was a gas. You're aghast.
I mean, I like him. I like him in this. Like, this is a good example of him knowing what his job is and doing it very well. Like, one of my favorite jokes in the movie is when he's chasing the Jeep with Chris Rock and Chris Elliott. His line is something like, "I'm not out of my mind," and it's because they got on the highway directly into LA traffic. Like, right. he gets the comedy of this movie perfectly. Yeah, he's no his brother, but yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying one is better than the other. I'm just saying I enjoy watching it more, and it could just be, you know, because I just, like, there's so much of Eddie Murphy out there.
That's true. He's given us more than we needed.
Right.
That's true.
The last fact on this Faxy segment was just a correction to the movie. I don't know why the opening credits say introducing Charlie Murphy. He was in a bunch of movies already, including Jungle Fever, Mo' Better Blues, Harlem Nights, he was no part of being introduced by this movie.
That's
so
kind
of
rude. And full of yourself, yeah. CB4.
Yeah. I know that Popstar really nailed it. And I think Popstar took a couple big cues from CB4. But this is my favorite escalating cameo sequence ever. like to go through, okay, obviously, yeah, I'm not surprised that Ice-T is here,
right?
Okay, like, you got Halle Berry as, like, your legitimate, oh, okay, there's way more big name rappers than I, and Shaq is here,
right?
And then ending it with Butthole Surfers, right, is the chef's kiss moment.
Like
we escalated to a footnote alternative band. It's so good.
And then the story that he tells about how, right, like, for a hot second I was about to Google Butthole Surfers and do a little research. Like, I wonder, and that would be funny if, like, I were to find out that dude was married to a black woman, and this was kind of like, you know, not like a real story, but still. But no,
let's just okay believe it's true.
Right?
Let's just assume it's true.
It made me go, I wonder what all of their songs, other than the one song I know, are like. I should listen to them now. Like I said, I enjoyed it. I think it was pretty funny. I think enough of the jokes work, as Robin said during the recap. Rapumentary is just pure accuracy as to how things were presented on MTV at that time. And Stabmaster Arson is my favorite name ever.
Yeah, that's really good.
Not to get derailed by the names again, but why did he need that name when he's got two buddies that had to come up with name and both came up with great names?
Exactly.
Dead Mike is good too.
Which the I fake just now
Quincy
got.
Jones.
I just got when Robin says Dead Mike in the recap. Oh, like a dead microphone. That's right. Funny. Right. I'm going to add 2 points on my score for that.
But when is trying to get him to pick a name with the very accurate joke, how about Ice Pick, Ice Coffee? Ice is big right now. It was like, it's so
Ice my dick,
like
they make the same joke in Fear of a Black Hat. He does have an ice name,
does he?
There's just so I'm sorry, it's just ridiculous how many jokes are the same, and these movies were made, this is my Faxy segment, is they just truly independently sprung up because they were satirizing the same culture. And Fear of a Black Hat premiered at Sundance and was like a big buzzy hit at Sundance, but then didn't get released until well after CB4. And when it got released, people were like, oh, well, CB4 did it.
I see. Tone deaf, tasty taste, and ice cold. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tone deaf. That's amazing.
Yep.
Yeah.
They also have a whole bit where the one guy becomes like super Pan-African spiritual.
Wow.
It's all the same.
So is this Coke and Pepsi, basically, is what you're saying.
Yes. Yes.
Capote and that other one. What was the other one?
Infamous.
infamous. I know. I just get tired of saying Dante's Peak Volcano or Armageddon Deep Impact right. all the time, because it happens a lot.
And it's A Bug's Life.
Right. Yes. But I liked it. I liked Chris Rock's constantly shifting fake walks. I like, because it was different every yeah. time. He yes. was, it's like, and you would see him walk normally, remember that he's supposed to walk
right.
fancy, and then try to make it up on the spot. And I love that every detail just felt like community theater NWA. Like, everything looked like NWA footage if no one was really committed to the production design. That was great. All of that said, boy, does it lose everything when it stops being a flashback. Because yeah. like, for 60 mm-hmm. minutes of this, they're stuck in freeway traffic to escape, and he's narrating his life story to Chris Elliott. Chris Elliott is great casting in that role, by the way. Oh. Then when he catches up and is like, well, now I have to see what happens, it just goes into like a weird shticky caper. And we finally have the sex scene, which like has some decent visual gags, and he like has his sad going back home. Like, none of that works. It's a funny yeah. movie. Even at the end, there are jokes that work, but it really falls apart once it gives up even more on its conceit.
This was still in the flashback segment, but when they have to get the bra undone, he takes out an escalating series of tools to take off a bra. I had a giggle fit.
I liked it. The show and the flip flop of like when Alan Payne is making love to her, as opposed, and she's like picking up Chris Rock and she's hoisting him onto the bed. One of the running gags that I really liked was as they're sitting in traffic, and every time they cut back to them talking in the cars is what's going on in the cars that are next to them. Like, there's at one point there's a guy with like full on rollers and he's drinking like whiskey out of a glass, and then like another point there's like headbangers like going on, and then another point I think there's like an alien, like somebody with an alien mask on or something. It's just a funny running gag.
Like, LA is weird stuff.
Yes.
And this is why I mentioned this in the intro. It did feel pretty remarkable for 1993 in a number one movie in America that they were kind of calling out the ways that the media fetishized gangster rap, that like calling out, you know, that there's this directed by A. White MTV, like, look at this real street people, we'll take you and show you, oh cool, it's a drive-by, like to have called that out in 1993 and having a, you know, subplot that didn't go anywhere but was still satisfying about politicians using gangster rap as a political crutch they didn't care about.
Right.
That this is much earlier than I expected a sort of mainstream movie to be making that commentary.
Well, it also,
yeah, I should have acknowledged Phil Hartman in my recap,
right,
as the
RIP
Al Gore stand-in. Yeah,
it was also, I know that there, you know, this is all parody. It's there's still a lot of things that I found extremely offensive. But there's also like, I know that there's a message here, but it's so deep underneath the shit, like underneath the vulgarity and everything, that I just feel like most people have missed everything that was there, that what they were really trying to say, like throughout all the bitches and the hoes and the pulling on my dick sack and all this kind of shit. Like, there was still like, there were two points where like I was like almost done. I was almost ready to just turn it off. And then what is her name? The Source journalist comes on, Teresa Randall, played by Teresa Randall. And he's calling her like all sorts of hoes and stuff and being real vulgar with her. And she checks him real quick and like tells him like basically mm-hmm. who the fuck she is and who the fuck she's not. And I was like, okay, thank you. I very much appreciate that. And then like a couple seconds later, like skip to like the next scene almost, Candy Alexander breaks down like the difference between a video hoe and like a businesswoman, which... I don't necessarily want to be like on board with what you're saying here, Candy, but like, sissy, this is it.
Just to be clear, her business is photographing men right. about to go down on her
exactly.
and then blackmailing them?
Right, yeah. Yeah. So, sissy, I kind of understand what sort of ish what you're trying yes. to say, but it's not exactly, like, we're kind of askew a little bit.
Also, just the idea that eating pussy is such like a who does this
right
thing in this movie is dated.
Yeah. Or what is his name that was called out on it recently? Khalid?
DJ Khaled.
Khaled, yeah. Which I still don't understand. I still don't know what the fuck he does. Like, is he a producer? Is he an actual DJ? Is he a rapper? Like, I don't...
He's a producer.
He is... It. I mean, that was a little bit of like, oh, I enjoyed him. Not because he... not because he does much, but because his ridiculous confidence in himself is inspiring. Because, like... He is a middling producer. Like you can listen to a DJ Khaled album. Every song features 8 people, and like a couple of them will be pretty good. Like All I Do Is Win is his biggest hit ever, right?
Yeah,
that was him.
Yeah, which featured 8 people, right? And then there's a remix which features 8 different people and doesn't change in any meaningful way, but. On every track, he has like 3 catchphrases. Another one, we the best music, and something else.
Those are just the names of his labels, I think.
Stop it.
he shouts them.
That's
incessant.
A normal thing. That's a thing that happens in pop music.
Not hate. To the level that he does.
Yeah, he's really
like Jason Derulo sings his own name frequently. Yeah. DJ Khaled does this on every track. Because he feels that just acknowledging himself improves everything around him.
Oh my God.
It's
Listen, I agree. I find him somewhat charming as a person and then just checked out fully when he was anti-oral sex.
I mean, the most joyous moment of the live action Aladdin is when the credits hit and the first thing you hear is "We the best music" and your mind puts together, oh, we're about to hear a DJ Khaled, Will Smith, never had a friend in me like me, right?
Wow.
And we are. Anyway. Oh, the MPAA doesn't really bear debating here. CB4 was rated R for strong language, sexuality, and drug content. Yep.
Correct.
Absolutely. I'd also like to give a shout out to Albert's father. He had some pretty great one-liners in there. Like, you know, the toaster's working, the VCR is working. How come you're not working? Like that's... And there was also this moment of towards the end where things were like unraveling. His moment of clarity or whatnot was like done with like the pseudo Spike Lee shot, like the floating and with the background, like him being still and then the background floating behind him. So I don't know if that's good or bad. I'm not sure yet.
I feel like that describes so many things in this movie. It's I don't know, but I did like it. And honestly, like, it's on HBO and it's less than 90 minutes long.
Right.
And so like, if you kind of feel like laughing, I recommend it almost. I don't know. It's one of those movies where I'm like, this is not good. I like it.
It trips me out because I was wondering like why the fuck like this was number one in the box office. And at some point I thought, well, maybe Chris Rock was like a really big star at this moment. No, he was not. And then I Googled how many black films were released in 1993. There were 1, 2, 6. 5.5
Oh my God. Yeah, you and said only this two, after we right. turned the recording off last week.
Right.
So and go only, ahead to and only it for our audience.
And only 2 of them made it to the number one. Poetic Justice is the other one. And that, I sort of kind of give it to that. But still, not even, like, Menace to Society was released in 93. I feel like that should have been number one. And What's Love Got to Do with It? Come on.
Amazing.
How is that not number one? Was that not number one? Like, this
there
was
must
like,
have been some kind of competition going on.
It must have been. I don't know exactly when it was released. But damn it to all to hell. Like, that movie needs to have all of the awards of all the time. Like, Angela Bassett. Like, everything about that fucking movie. Everything is everything about that movie. Again, it was just like, maybe the content, I guess Chris Rock was big as a stand-up comedian. I don't know. And just the fact that, you know, it was very few black films that got wide release in around that time period. And it was just like, all right, this is what we're doing. And I didn't check to see, like, when in 93 this was released. Was this, like, summer?
March 12th.
Oh, this is March. Okay.
So it was a little bit slow, but yeah, right. I mean, this has happened. There are so many moments. It's finally stopping kind of, well, the whole box office has stopped now, but the surprise story has started to go away. Until like the last 4 years, there would be these weeks that a black movie went to number one, and the Hollywood Reporter is like, what an upset. And every time it's the same reason. Every time it's like, yeah, there's all of these people who you don't give movies to, right, that you gave one to, and they showed up. And there was, I mean, every time Tyler Perry went to number one, people were stunned, because it was like, these aren't good. They get terrible reviews. Like, yeah, but there's an only so much on the market. And it was a slower time of year. In fact, Tony, again, working overtime, this ended a 2-week number one reign for Falling Down, the Joel Schumacher movie that Robin hates.
Which we just talked about a couple weeks ago.
Right.
Yeah.
So presupposing that Falling Down is meant to be a satire, the world was hungry for watered down satire.
And Loaded Weapon 1 was 2 weeks before that. So yes, watered down satire.
Yeah. Wow.
So let's rate it. I gave it a 65. Well north of average, but not into anything I would tell you to run out and see.
Also a 65.
Oh, wow. 54.
Did you add your 2 points?
I did.
Okay. Dead Mike. What I was about to bring up is, HBO Max the one that like has a higher percentage where it's just worth watching than most of the other services? Like, everything I've picked out arbitrarily to watch on HBO Max has been at least pretty good, and they have a ton of movies. Like, the only times I've seen something on there and I was like, oh, that's real bad, is if it was like new and still had enough buzz that they threw it on there. I feel like they just care if the movie is decent more than most services.
Maybe they've got better programmers.
It's an interesting hypothesis. Some counter hypotheses are that when you first join any streaming service, it's like, look at this wonderful cornucopia of content. And then you quickly burn through the good stuff, like Disney Plus. Then also the Turner Classic Movies Library, which is a whole underrepresented pool of movies and streaming services. So that like raises the average content.
This is just after last night watching Death Becomes Her for the first time and going, oh, this is a weird, weird, but cool thing.
Colin and I was going to talk about it, and you can't handle the truth.
You also watched Death Becomes Her on HBO Max?
I did. And I have the same review.
We'll get to that in a minute. The final score was 61 2/3, just about as middle of the pack as you can get. That is the same score we gave Finding Dory. Within a half a point of Jagged Edge. These sound like movies that we thought were okay. Again, is there anything going off of the bingo card?
I want to say that Albert and Rachel True broke up.
And the band broke up.
True.
I agree.
Other than that, I think you meant actual biopic and not fake biopic. I think we needed Straight Outta Compton and not CB4. I think it's just breakup. Does anyone have a bingo?
Nope.
It is time for You Can't Handle the Truth. I didn't expect it, but man, is Death Becomes Her the relevant topic of the day. So, it's super weird.
What a weird, great movie. I mean, great.
I don't know if it's like, oh man, that what an underappreciated gem. No, I'm not sure it worked, but I loved watching it.
My reaction over and over again is like, wow, do they not make movies like this anymore? And just the fact that they had two female stars plus 40, you know?
Right. Bruce Willis was great, but Isabella Rossellini was really great.
And crazy hot.
She always is, but you forget until you look at her for more than 30 seconds, and then you're like, wait a minute.
I watched My Spy. Is that what the James Batista movie is that we talked about last week? I watched that immediately after watching Death Becomes Her. I also really liked it.
Nice.
And then I was kind of like, do I like this because I'm in a good mood because it's my wedding anniversary and I've had some champagne and I just watched Death Becomes Her.
You enjoyed it.
Whatever. I enjoyed it. And again, it's free on streaming and it's relatively short. If you need a good time, I think you should try it.
Exactly.
Did I not like it because I was vaguely aware that the entire movie industry was about to shut down and this might be my final critic screening ever, and I was pissed off that it was My Spy? Maybe that hurt my enjoyment. There were scenes I liked. The two played off of each other really well. Like, it's in the trailer, but when he's teaching her to lie and she says, I think all of your tattoos are cool, and blinks. It's like, oh. Camila, you can't handle the truth.
Oh, watching that Fatal Affair on Netflix.
Oh yeah.
Oh boy, that was.
Who the fuck thought it was a good idea to put Omar Epps in that role? Like, honestly, like, he is neither he's not believable as menacing or sexy, like, attractive or just like anybody.
He's really not sexy.
No.
Like, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Mike Tomlin doppelganger Omar Epps, but like,
used to be sexy.
Never. I never found him attractive or sexy.
I thought he was sexy when he was on ER a million years ago.
He was on ER.
Yeah, briefly.
Wow.
Well, like, things are getting, like,
it's horrible.
Things are getting hot and heavy in the club before they almost have the titular Fatal Affair.
Right.
And I'm like, I don't feel any chemistry here. Like, for either of you.
No, I just felt embarrassed for the both of them. I was like, you guys make me sad. Like, this is something. This is not. And then to look at her husband, like, who, like, for real? Like, really? You were, and it's just, it didn't make any sense. Like, it didn't seem like that she was being mistreated or ignored at home. So why wouldn't, whatever. It's just
the heart wants what it wants.
It's a piece of shit movie. And somebody pointed out, I was like, they keep making this movie. And there was like a list of like six other ones that were pretty much like it. And among them was No Good Deed, which, much better one. If you want to watch any of those, watch that one. No Good Deed. Very well, but very well done.
Maybe it's because the previous Netflix one of these by the same director, Secret Obsession, was way worse than this. And like, don't get me wrong, Fatal Affair was not good. But I flirted with the idea of giving it fresh anyway, because I'm like, you got what you came for. Like, you spent 90 minutes yelling at a nice lady to not get herself killed. Like, I ended up being like, no, okay, I can't actually vote thumbs up on this movie. But, like, it did what it came there to do.
Yeah, that's I mean, yeah, there's a definite audience for that. And most of them don't give a shit, like, whether it's like actually good or anything, if the script or the plot makes any point, or if the dialogue is interesting, or if anybody is actually, if it has any real chemistry, or if anything makes sense, or, you know, if you even really give a shit about any of these characters, they don't care. It's fine. Whatever. In my alphabetical, I finally moved on in my DVD, in my Blu-rays, and now I'm up to Elf. So Christmas in July, folks. I'm about to break my rule that Elf cannot be played before Thanksgiving in my house or after New Year's Day.
Listen, it's a pandemic.
Right.
Society's breaking down. Speaking of society breaking down, Sean, you asked me to ask you for a fun fact about Tenet, which, as we record, has been indefinitely delayed. Yay!
Warner Brothers finally went, we don't know. We don't know, okay? We don't know when the movie's coming out. Sorry. Which,
thank you. That's, like, all we want is some honesty. Just
right.
So many movies delayed a year, or at least well into the fall at the beginning, because they figured this shit out. Warner is, like, weirdly defensive. Robin sent me to this whole tweet thread about how, like, they put out a press release begging journalists to be nice when they reported on it. It's like, you made this problem yourself.
This press release, first of all, says, like, in the press release that part of it is off the record, according to the person who tweeted it, which is weird. That's not a thing. That's not what press releases are.
Right.
You don't mail me an unsolicited off the record.
But then additionally, it's like, hey, film journalist, your career depends on there being film. And I'm kind of like, they've got their own problems.
Right. How dare you?
You know, none of us have jobs right now, right? Do you know how many working film journalists there are? Like, this is more your problem than mine at this point. But I read a slightly longer thing yesterday, and this fills me with schadenfreude joy. The one thing they're toying about is saying the hell with it and releasing it in the smart countries where they have the virus under control. Like, they're talking about, like, his movies make a lot of money overseas anyway, which they do. So they're going to do the worldwide release and get to the U.S. when they have time for it, which they should. The second biggest market after North America is China. They're not allowed to release Tenet in China. Why? Because as a COVID control measure, you're not allowed to show a movie that's more than 2 hours long. And this being a Christopher Nolan movie, Tenet is right out. I hope they made the plan before they learned that rule. They were like, you know what? The hell with it. We're going to China.
Oh, no, you're not.
What?
China's like,
that's so good. Because you know that someone at Warner Brothers had to call him and go, could you edit it down to...
Exactly what I was just going to talk about. I don't know. I have built up Christopher Nolan in my head as the biggest jackass of all time, which is possibly unfair. But imagining someone asking him to cut his movie down below 2 hours is...
Oh, I'm sure that would send him into a fiery rage. Like, people...
It gives me...
His whole entire house staff would just be fired. Like, he's just like... going through their house just ripping shit up. Yeah.
I mean, if the presence of chairs sends him into a fiery rage, what will that do?
Does not believe in dinosaurs.
Man, this is why my scores are never 100, because sometimes I get really behind something, like I got really behind Interstellar, and look what I got for that.
I also rewatched Inception this week. Inception is great. Does it really make sense? Does it need to really make sense? Super great movie. Dude. I like a lot of Christopher Nolan's movies. I hated Interstellar. And I think that that sent me down a path of, it's like Aaron Sorkin, where I'm like, I like your stuff, but I hate you so much that I almost don't.
Yeah, I like a lot of Christopher Nolan stuff. Inception, you're right. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but it's beautiful. Like all the choreography and just the fights and the like Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Come on, son. Like, yes.
I rewound and watched the rotating hallway part a second time. Yes. I was like, I need it again.
Right? And then that just like in some random like little bits of Tom Hardy. Yes. Oh.
Yes. Tom Hardy. I'm coming around on Tom Hardy. For a long time, I was anti-Tom Hardy, but something switched in my head.
You should watch The Pandemic.
Society's breaking down. What should I watch?
The Drop, with him and James Gandolfini. I just rewatched that last night, and it's so good. Like, he's just like, the characters he plays are just so, like, you never, like, you just, I just want to know, like, I know what the screenwriter and the directors, what they think the characters are that they give Tom Hardy, but I want to know what Tom Hardy thinks these characters are. Like, what's the backstory he gives them? What is his character breakdown? Because it's all very off.
He makes weird choices.
He does. And mostly they work.
What's the one where he's alone in the car for the whole movie?
Is it Locke?
Locke. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the proof, right? Because it's still kind of good. Right. And like, you have to be ridiculously good at acting to be like, yep, this whole movie is, you're just going to look at me and the camera's going to pan a little bit. And it works.
Yeah. Oh, and I guess I did watch another movie. I went to Peacock and I watched the Psych 2 movie, Lassie Come Home, which was enjoyable. Like, Psych is a favorite in my household. Dan and I really like that show. And damn it, like the guy who plays Lassiter, Timothy Olmanson, he had a stroke in real life and they brought him back. His character also has a stroke. And it was good and it was funny and everything, but it was also just like every time he was on screen, it was very apparent that he had a real stroke and he's not exactly the same person that he was. And I bawled like throughout most of the movie. Just like, it's so sad. It's because it's real. But, you know, I mean, if you're not like a sad sack like me, you should probably go watch it.
I think that would make me sad too, but I also dug Psych, so maybe I'll watch it.
The reason I really enjoy Psych is, well, one of the many reasons is that there's so many like callbacks, like the jokes, mm-hmm. and there's so many like pop culture like dings and stuff. It's always really good.
I just have a drive-in movie theater programming note from my experience on Saturday. Saturday, I went to see Evil Dead at the drive-in. There's a company called Grindhouse Releasing, which I guess has the like repertory distribution rights to some old horror movies. They're sending Evil Dead around. It was very, very cool. It was sold out. They sold every ticket they could.
It's like a perfect drive-in movie.
Yeah, yeah. It was a very good choice. However, this particular drive-in had 4 screens. Those 4 screens showed 2 movies each. So there were 8 places you could have put physical locations and times, points in space, where you could have put Evil Dead. And they chose the one that would mean that if guests leaving after the end of Shrek on screen 1 wanted to exit the complex, they had to drive directly past the Evil Dead screen at the end, where all of the deadites just melt for 4 minutes.
Avert your eyes, children.
Right. Timmy, cover your eyes.
The first really? Time I went to a drive-in, I saw What Lies Beneath, and the screen next to it was playing the first Pokemon movie. And it was very distracting.
There's a number that are like that. And like the easy solution is just put the really adult thing on late. Because right. even when it's like a lot of these places have family double features, that was Shrek and Despicable Me. Either families are going to leave after the first movie because it's 11:15 or the kids are going to fall asleep. Right. It's fine. I am always confused when there's murder or nudity happening, like, and then you turn your head and oh, there's The Secret Life of Pets. It's very, very young. Should we draw a movie?
Let's do it.
The number is 1187, getting down towards the end of the list.
Oh no.
Sorry to make that noise. Did that give it away? I think this was the last thing that was added before we started the podcast. We're like 3 weeks at the beginning of 2019. Were won by the dreadful Bryan Cranston, Kevin Hart buddy movie, The
Dude,
Upside.
Are you serious?
The Upside. You know, he teaches an old man how to love life. I don't know.
Do I have a veto?
Yeah.
You do.
Veto the fuck out of this thing.
I'm exercising my veto, man.
Hey! Thank you, Camila. Thank you. I didn't want to exert any pressure on you.
No, I haven't seen it, but I've heard so many horrible things, and I don't have the energy to hate this movie next week. Like,
it legitimately has a scene where it's like, well, this is classical music. Maybe you can appreciate. Oh my god.
No, I don't have that. I don't have it in me.
It barely moved. 1158 is. Bad week. But 1158 is Transformers The Last Night.
I think that's supposed to be one of the good ones.
That's supposed to be one of the ones that didn't suck. Camila threw off her headphones and left the room.
I still think you did us a service.
I think it's a step up.
Which Transformers?
I genuinely think this is going to be better.
Transformers The Last Night.
Night with a K.
Night with a K. From 2017. Yeah, there were two of them. It was this and the spinoff Bumblebee.
Right.
Where people were like, no, it's kind of good. And I was like, fuck you. I'm not watching that. Even as a movie critic, I am not. There's no way.
Mark Wahlberg. But, this movie is 2.5 motherfucking hours. Why?
No.
Why? Why? Michael. Ooh. Michael Bay. Oh, and Anthony Hopkins? Anthony Hopkins? Or is he just a voice?
Anthony Hopkins has to pay rent on his castle.
This is the one where, like, Anthony Hopkins recorded it, and then it came out that, like, they tried to get him to do press, and he was like, no, I don't even know what this movie's about. I didn't read the script. You gave me a speech to read, and I read it. That's it.
All right.
Mark Wahlberg yelling at machinery.
This is not the good one. I went to critical response, and it's the film has an approval rating of 15% and an average rating of 3.2, giving it the lowest rating of the six films in the Transformers series.
Right.
We got a receipt because I vetoed the first one earlier in the year. Right.
Right. Yeah.
And I probably shouldn't have because, you know, anytime the first one is easier to watch because, you know, it's a little easier to kind of debate.
Right.
The beginning of something. This is why we have rules. It's not fun if everything is good.
Right.
I'd like to congratulate Rob Zombie's Halloween, which may no longer be our worst ranked movie in just one short week. CB4 was March 12th, 1993. What was the number one song in America?
Mariah Carey?
No, that's, hey, when I went in doubt, guess Mariah Carey, mm-hmm. and she did dominate a good chunk of that year with Dream Lover and Hero by the end of the year, but no.
Tupac?
No, we are looking for, I think it's safe to say, a one-hit wonder.
Oh, interesting.
Borders, for 1993, this almost counts as a novelty hit.
Cantaloupe? I love Us that Three? Song. I know, that's so good.
I guess you'd call this hip-hop very generously.
Shaggy?
No, when I first told my computer to play this here, it served me the original version, which was not in English.
Macarena?
No, about 3-4 years early on Macarena. One hit wonder, a one named one hit wonder. His one name.
Oh, Snow?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Informer. Okay.
Yes.
Was it originally in French?
French? Why would it be in French?
He's Canadian.
When I told this thing, by the way, I'm not going to do it again because last week I said the Google wake word on the podcast and then listening back to it, my Google woke up. So sorry to all of our listeners whose digital assistants I inadvertently activated last week. When I asked for this song, it came in Spanish. Informer is a 1992 song by Canadian reggae musician Snow. Unless that was just Google's mistake.
I think it's hilarious to imagine that song in French. I'm going to go listen to Cantaloupe. That's a much better song.
Yes.
Can you listen to it enough times that you forget about Transformers?
Number one.